Welcome to the Secure AF Podcast. We've got a great topic today. I'm Jonathan Kimmett. With me, I've got Andrew Hernandez, and we're going to be talking about security from a broad perspective, information security, cybersecurity, all the different kinds of security. And what's interesting about this is we talk about security all the time.
We do.
We talk about the things that we need to do all the time, but a lot of times people don't understand what it is.
I know it's there's always a lot of buzzwords that get thrown around, and you know, they sound really cool, and everyone goes, "Yeah, we did that. We got a piece of that. We hired this person, or we got this service to help us out with that." But do they even know what that is? What are they doing? Right? What's the meat of that? Right?
That's kind of really what we wanted to talk about. So before we get started, tell us a little bit about yourself, Andrew. Who are you and where are you from?
My name's Andrew Hernandez. I'm Director of Risk Management for Trap Technology. It's a relatively new position for me here at Trap. I've been there about almost 6 months now, but I've spent all of my professional career in IT and financial services, security, risk, and governance. And so joined Trap here to just kind of, I'm trying to grow my career a little bit more and become more of a consultant versus it was interesting. I started a YouTube channel, a cooking YouTube channel about 18 months ago. And there's all these little helpers and groups and things out there. Hey, you can do this, you can do that. And it kind of registered with me as hey, I don't really want to be doing the things anymore. I want to help people consult to do the things. So it kind of resonated in my professional career as well. It's like, I don't really want to be up at midnight doing incident response. I'd rather help people do it themselves or that kind of thing. So,
and that's the thing is, you know, there's a lot of need out there, and you know,
indeed,
you know, GRC is something close to my heart. I've been doing it for a very long time, and you know, and that's actually what we were talking about before the podcast was that GRC is really kind of that preventative part of security versus the reactive part of security. And we're going to get to that in just a minute. But I'm really glad you're on the podcast today. And I think we've just the conversations we've had in the last 10 minutes isn't going to be a lot of fun. We do have a small audience back here. So if we get some giggles and stuff, that's going to be a wonderful thing. We've never had like a clap track or, any of those. So maybe we can actually get some laughter or something in the background on this. And everyone is looking at us.
We get some applause signs over here.
There you go. Okay. So let's kind of get started right into the topic. Information security versus cybersecurity.
Right.
Those sorts of things people use interchangeably.
Indeed, they do.
And they're not the same thing.
My opinion is no. Although there's been, I think there's a lot of opinions out there that says, you know, cybersecurity sort of replaced the word for information security because it sounds cool, it's sexy, and everyone's like, "Ooh, cyber," you know. But
and I think those people are wrong.
I do as well, because it's a lot more than just cybersecurity is there to simply put it is to, you know, we talked about it a little bit earlier, the detective and reactive.
Yeah.
But it's really, I think, focused more on technology versus, like you mentioned, GRC, governance, and some of the more preventative things.
Yeah. And, you know, something I said many years ago when GDPR came out, you know, they had this concept of the data protection officer, you know, and it's built into GDPR, and we're not, this is not going to be a GDPR podcast. We've done that before. But what I really like saying is the CISO was the very first DPO. Because the chief information security officer was that person who was otherwise protecting information within the organization. Now, they did it with cybersecurity concepts and tools and all kinds of things, but it was that information security that was the key piece, you know, protecting that information. So I've always kind of leaned off towards that information security because I'm very much preventative. I'm a CISO, and I use those tools, you know, the cybersecurity tools. But I use the tools to protect the information. So that's kind of how I look at it.
Yeah. And, you know, those are really just layers on top of your whole security approach. I hail from financial services and, you know, GLBA has always been something that I've been very familiar with. And, you know, it's had to work with auditors and examiners, make sure you're compliant. But it was before the whole an information security officer. It was before chief, pre-CISO, right? Similar to GDPR, they, hey, you have to have this data protection officer. You have to have an information security officer. And they're not just looking at all the security controls. We're also looking at, you know, paper files in a filing cabinet. What kind of physical security do you have? And all those kinds of things, right?
Well, when I do a GOBA audit, you know, I go in and it's not just a firewall audit and a pen test. You know, I walk around the building. I talk to people. I open doors and it's like, hey, this door was unlocked. There's data on this desk.
Right.
But what's interesting, you know, because, you know, I do a lot of compliance, but GOBA, one of the new requirements is a designated qualified individual.
Yeah.
And that's one of those new ones that came out. And I guess those new requirements came out in 2021, but it took effect in 2023. But that qualified was really important because that's different in their guidelines than it ever has been before. But it's a designated qualified individual in charge of an information security program. And that really caught a lot of people. I mean, what does qualified mean?
Right.
So that's, I'm really glad they're doing that though, because I think it's really, really important.
For sure. You know, I had a conversation with a client just last week, actually. They are going to be subject to NY 500, which is the New York State equivalent, GLBA, GDPR, so forth. But there's a lot of focus on cybersecurity, but also one of the requirements is a qualified chief information security officer. And even saying so far as that, you know, not necessarily just qualified, but also it could be internal, it could be third party.
Right.
But it was interesting to see that they essentially are requiring this organization to have a CISO in some form or fashion.
And I think that really goes back to what we were talking about, because that qualified part is the part that, what is the value to the organization? What is that CISO doing? Or, I mean, it could be a different title, but, you know, the concept of, you know, qualified individual. But it's prepping their programs, their business for information security. I mean, that's what GOBA is all about. That's what GDPR is about. It's about information security. And a lot of times, if you don't know what that means, you don't have the tools that you really need from the organizational point of view to be successful at that. Now, the question is, what is successful at that? Because I think that that's really the key piece. So when I say information security to you, give me some examples. What's the top of your head, the tip of the tongue type of thing of blah is information security?
Really just protecting data. And because I have a lot of experience with financial services, it's really about the individual's data, information.
Yes.
GDPR focuses on that, GLBA, of course, as well. And so that's what I think about is like, and it, of course, that's the high risk data, but it's all data. It's corporate public, you know, corporate information that might not want to be out there in public.
Sure. I mean,
but even the public information to a degree has to be somewhat protected or at least assessed, right?
Right.
Is this, you know, what is this data? What is this info?
I've got a friend who I was talking to over the weekend, and he was telling me about some new regulations that are coming out that's even requiring the protection of the data that's not really PII, but it's also data that you could use to identify someone. And the example that we were using, or the example we were talking about, is club memberships, you know, like Costco and Sam's and all these different ones, or any of them, any merchant that you have. But if they could take the information of all the stuff that you buy and get a profile on you to see who you are and what you do, that's going to be most likely protected information from this point forward if all this stuff passes and everything. And for me, from a GDPR perspective, absolutely. That's indirect identification of the individual.
Right.
And that's really important to protect in some cases, but it's new. It's different.
I
mean, it's not PII.
It's not
personally identifiable information, but it's still identifying information and it's still something that we should protect.
And that's why I think, you know, it's a good distinction we make about information security, cybersecurity.
Yep.
Because oftentimes you're talking with organizations about, well, do you have this? Do you have that? And they go, yeah, we have this, so we don't need that. Like, no, not necessarily, because
right.
if I get a hold of this, then now I can
yes.
create that profile. I have an opportunity to pivot and maybe gain more information
right.
or access, right? And so that's
right.
why you have preventative and detective. It's not
yeah.
just about
yeah.
one or the other.
So in my previous life as a CISO, I worked at a university. And when GDPR came out, I kind of went through and I did the GDPR auditing to see if what we were going to have to do. And I really got into it. I really enjoy the why GDPR exists and using it as a framework. But one of the things that really caught me when I was learning about it was their idea of PII versus sensitive PII. And at the university, so what PII is, for those that are just listening or watching, PII is your regularly used personally identifiable information. So your name, your address, social security number, date of birth, all these different things. But sensitive PII, something that they protect even more, are things such as group memberships, political affiliations, sexual orientation,
oh, interesting.
Religion. And that point of view is kind of unique.
Yeah.
And it was kind of hard to wrap my head around originally. But then I got into the history of GDPR. And so when you take your, there's a certification out there, it's CIPPE. And when I was preparing for that, I had to learn the history of GDPR. Well, the history of GDPR actually goes back to the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights back in the late 40s, right after World War II, when the United Nations started figuring out all the atrocities that were happening to a whole bunch of people. Right. So the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights. And in that, they actually had a section in there that privacy is a human right. Mm. Now, that UN Declaration of Human Rights kind of goes down through history, eventually becomes the Data Privacy Directive, which is the specific predecessor to GDPR. But even in GDPR, there's those sections in there that privacy is a human right. And again, the reason why they wrote this is because of all the atrocities that were happening during World War II, specifically because religious or political affiliations, or a whole variety. It wasn't sure. just a single group of people that, you know, terrible things happened to. But they basically said, we don't want this to happen again. So now let's go back to the University of Tulsa. And I had this... I found this report that was being generated in one of the departments, and it had fraternities and sororities on the list. And I went to the department. It's like, why do you need this? And they go, oh, well, we use that for our data analysis, and we do this and this and this. I was like, really? You do? I was like, let me ask you, would you ever deny class admission to somebody in a fraternity or sorority? Oh, absolutely not. We would never do that. It's like, okay, would you ever deny any university services based off a sorority or fraternity membership? Oh, absolutely not. We would never do that.
Or would you, you know, have a preference of one person
right.
over another because of some sort of affiliation?
Right. And they're like, well, no, we would never do that. And it's like, then why do you need that data? And they're like, well, we never thought of it like that. And so... I got to yank out a lot of that from all those reports because they just don't need it. And from GDPR's perspective, that's a group affiliation or political affiliation that's really considered sensitive PII.
Yeah.
So now I'm thinking that these new rules coming down that people are trying to pass kind of gets into a little bit of that. It's we have PII that is protected. And honestly, we have protections for PII. I mean, we've got FERPA, GOBA, HIPAA, mm-hmm. FTC. I mean, we have all these different protections, you know, groups out there that's protecting this data, but we're not protecting some of that other data, that sensitive PII or the indirect identification information like you would in like the Costco membership cards
right.
and stuff. And I'm not picking on Costco, by the way. It was just what popped into my head. But those things are important.
They really are.
And we should protect them. And I think that that's where people don't really think about it is they don't go, oh, that is important stuff. That is important stuff that, you know, if we don't do that, people can actually get hurt.
They can, because you're, and you know, you don't think about that. I think when you're forking it over or what have you, it's like,
yeah,
you know, here's my gender, here's my profession, all these kinds of things. It's a good way to target someone, you know, or at least weed out those that you want to target, because you might feel like
absolutely
someone in IT security is probably not someone you might want to target, but versus someone else.
Well, and this is kind of the danger of, you know, doing those DNA things. You send your DNA and people were, insurance companies were wanting to buy this data from them because if they felt like someone based off their DNA was more susceptible to whatever, they could raise insurance. I'm not saying they do that. I'm just saying that people were talking about that. And that's really difficult because, I mean, there's a value there of your genetics and, but what's the harm? You know, what could have been used in terms of the harm of that data?
It makes me think, you know, and at some points, like, you know, I don't necessarily need to know any of this information. Why are we collecting it all? And to your earlier point, right? Like, if you're not using it.
Yep.
Why is there even a question? Why is there a box to fill this in?
Right.
What does it matter?
Well, and actually that's where I've always, you know, when I'm talking about privacy versus security, I always say, you know, there's this overlap, you know, when we're talking about privacy and security, and privacy tells you the data you can have, and then security secures that data.
Right.
But privacy will limit you. You know, based off the requirements of GDPR and whatever, GLBA, if you don't need that data, if you don't have a business need for it, don't collect it. Because if I've got to deploy a bunch of security controls around stuff that we shouldn't have in the first place, that's a bad idea.
It really is.
Now, one of the questions I love asking, I have asked this on the podcast before, is has anyone ever died because of a data breach? And the answer is yes, and I use a couple of different examples for that. But in some of the cases I use in my examples, the data was not supposed to be there. They kept it. They lied. They kept it. Then it got released, and people died because of it. So that's an interesting thing.
That's a bit deep and dark. I didn't really didn't really go there. I often use the analogy or the example with organizations is that, you know, in addition to security, you're paying, you know, money for storage and backup and all these things. Like, you don't need to keep, do you even have a requirement to retain this much data?
Right.
Absolutely not. Or if you do, you've gone way beyond it, right? And so you have all this additional cost associated with it that you don't need to.
Well, it's also additional lack of sleep because you got to worry about this data.
Right.
I don't get enough sleep in the current world. But no, I mean, it's data is a key factor. And it's, you know, I know you said it before where data becomes kind of that focal point of, or the data subject, you know, people, becomes that focal point of why you do security. Now, when we're talking about confidential data in an organization, maybe it's patent data or research data or whatever, you want to protect it for sure. But you're also still dealing with people because if the organization loses that data, they might go under. People will lose their jobs. And, you know, there's all these different things that if you don't think about the people side of security, then you kind of get lost in the technical stuff. And that's where a lot of people want to live is they want to live in the firewalls. They want to live.
It's fun and cool and we get it.
It is.
But there's a whole other aspect to it. And, you know, we're talking with a lot of organizations lately, you know, obviously we deal with a lot of healthcare, a lot of financial services. They have these requirements to do these things, you know, regulatory requirements and things like that. But there's a lot of small business out there that often have like nothing in place, which is a bit scary coming just, you know, it's just, I think it's been imparted in me now. It's like you have to, you can't not do these things, right? And so you know, you get to know these organizations and realize they have almost nothing, and bad guys don't care anymore.
No.
Because, you know, they're not going after just banks. They're casting a really wide net. And
well, sure. I mean, if you think about it.
Businesses go under. People lose their jobs, right?
If you, Fortune 500 companies, most of them have put a lot of money into security.
Oh, for sure.
Either because they've been attacked or they've had a breach or something, but they've put a lot of money in. So we'll just give them that. But how many small businesses are there? I mean, what is it, like 95% of the people in the country? I'm making this number up. 95% of the people in the country are hired by the equivalent of a small business, or it's some outrageous number of, when we think about all the different small businesses versus these Fortune 500 companies,
right?
It's incredible. This is a funny little thing. I was interviewing for one of the big four firms for a privacy audit type position. And I went through three different interviews. And the last two were primary principals of the organization. I asked a question to every person that I interviewed, except for the HR person. And my question was, what are you doing for small business? And all three of them was like, nothing. We are Fortune 500s.
Wow.
That is such a small segment of the organizations out there. I mean, there's so many small businesses. So I promptly, this is a true story. After I had that interview, I called up HR and says, all right, I don't want to interview any further. Which upsets HR, by the way. They don't like it when someone calls them and tells them that. But I reached out to my local Tulsa Tech school, and I offered them a cybersecurity for small business class. So nice. I teach that.
Oh, wow.
Because I want those small businesses to have something.
Right.
And we don't get a lot of people in the class, but it's still something because these small businesses have our data.
Right. And, you know, you don't necessarily need to have a grand cybersecurity program, information security program. If you got something at least to respond, or at least to know, you know, what are the things that could happen to me?
Right.
And how would I even respond? You know, because most of the time, you know, we like to say, you've got this great big plan, you're going to test it. And you know, that can work in some cases. But in a lot of things, things just happen. And you're like, I didn't even remotely think about that. And you just...
Yeah.
We all kind of just work together on the fly and
solve
problems. And but it's pretty scary to think about, you know, someone out there just trying to make a living and maybe help out the community or what have you. And
they are, and you know, and it's not their fault by any means. It's just they don't know,
right?
I mean, I had one woman that was in my class, and it was day two of the class, so it's a 2-day class. And every time I went to a new topic, she goes, Jonathan, every time you say something, you cost me money. Well, I don't mean to cost you money. He goes, no, I think it's right. But every time you say
it, but
that you're costing me money, it's like, okay, that's fair. But to that end, let's actually talk about the physical security or the technical security side, because we've talked a lot about the data and the protecting of the data and protecting of people. But, you know, let's talk about that holistic view of the cybersecurity, the technical security. Again, if you walk away from those very, very large companies, those Fortune 500s, or, you know, organizations that have, you know, have a budget of $10 million for the cybersecurity, which with $10 million, you could do a lot. But most organizations don't have that.
No.
What do you see as these... really critical, maybe the top, I'll put him on the fly for real quick.
Here we go.
These top three or five things that organizations are not doing, but should be doing to protect that data that they have, that information security.
From a physical security perspective?
Yeah.
I mean, locked doors are one, right?
Absolutely.
Lots of times you walk into a business or a building, and there's very lacking physical, you know, in terms of locked doors or just awareness. People have entered my facility.
Yeah.
I don't know who they are, but they might look like what they know what they're doing, or they just see somebody. But I think also people, it probably comes down to training as well.
Right.
Because people, I think, inherently just avoid other people if they can, if they don't have engage with the person. Like, I don't know what you want. And unless you're going to come to ask me something, then I'm just going to ignore
even
you.
Even if it's their job.
Right. Right.
They still do that.
I remember working in the bank. We always had to, you know, training new tellers. It's like people enter the lobby and the first thing we train is like, hello, hi, welcome.
Yep.
We'll be right with you. Even if it's, I can't help you right away, to acknowledge them. But it's also, there's a security aspect to that, right?
Yes.
It's like now the person knows that.
Someone has seen them.
Exactly.
Someone has acknowledged
that. It's important to acknowledge someone is entering your building like that.
So. Yeah. Okay. So that's number one. And I wholly agree with that. We find that all the time where we just walk right in.
Right.
All right. Just give me another one.
Surveillance is probably another good one. And, you know, it's something that a lot of us are doing at home now anyway.
Yeah.
And not having it in your business just seems kind of like a no-brainer, right? I mean, everyone's these days, I mean, how many videos are posted on TikTok and YouTube of people at your front door, right? You know, why not do the same for your business?
So I go back and forth on that. I agree with you. But I also understand it from the GDPR perspective.
Yeah.
Because the EU doesn't allow you to put cameras in your business.
Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. So
that's interesting.
The way they say it is you have to go to the data protection authority to get approval to put cameras in your business, and it has to be for a specific need.
Hmm.
You can't just put it in for general surveillance. And what they say is the privacy of your employees overrides the requirement for those. Now, if it's a safety issue, absolutely, they're going to approve it. Or if there's a theft issue,
right?
But it's only for a limited time.
That's interesting you say that too, because I was talking with a buddy of mine a few weeks ago, works for a bank, and he's in California. So they have CCPA, and there's a lot of, talk about, you know, the privacy of people's just walking by your, you have my, especially the today, facial recognition and stuff like that, using that for other purposes and whatnot.
So
it's an interesting perspective, but I also think, you know, not to sound authoritarian or what have you, but also people don't necessarily have the right to that kind of privacy at their employers, you know.
EU argues with you, though.
I'm sure they do. Fine line on myself. I don't necessarily agree with it 100%, but it's not your home, right?
That's true. That's true.
You know, you have left your premises. You're there to do a job. Yeah. You're not there to be in this private world or what have you, but I don't know.
I know a guy, and this would have been the late 90s, who his job was doing DVRs. He did DVRs and cameras and stuff.
I mean, we started on DVRs, man.
Yeah. but he was telling me that they went into a very large airport, very large for the United States, and they put a camera in every bathroom stall. Now, the reason they did that is because they were having problems with people doing bad stuff in the stalls. But 6 months later, they had to yank them back out because of the privacy issues. And, you know, he didn't understand why they had to yank them back out, because it was preventing a particular threat, or it was helping
deterring
them. Helping investigate a particular threat. But then you got that balance of privacy. So
you do. And I mean, that's certainly something to consider. You know, when you enter a bathroom, you obviously have.
Right. Right.
But you're at your desk or in a lobby where public people are entering.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a very different mindset.
It certainly is.
You know, and I can see it both sides.
Yeah, for sure. I do. I just feel like, you know, it's at least something to consider when you're looking at your whole security program.
Yep.
You know,
yep.
Hey, do I need to have this? Obviously, you know, I come from financial services, so surveillance in the lobby is just, that's where I go. Right. So,
and in when I did it, I've done cameras before, and most of the time it was for asset retention. You know, we weren't doing surveillance. It was just for asset retention so we could see what was happening after the fact. You know, it was an active surveillance. But, you know, the whole idea of it is just like any other logs, do you have it? can you go back and watch it? Mm-hmm. Does it actually tell you anything? You know, sometimes you put a camera up on a lobby, you can't really tell anything because it's so far away, it's so grainy, whatever the case is. So there's an art form to it. It's an art form of doing cameras, doing it the right way. We were always putting the cameras facing in at the exits because we wanted to see their face as they were leaving.
Yeah.
And most people will put it facing out on the entrance.
Uh-huh.
Which is two different thought processes.
Sure.
Do you want to catch them as they're entering and get their face, or do you want to catch them as they're leaving and get their face? So it's just a mindset.
It is. And we also often have them, you know, at designated areas inside the lobby because you kind of also want to get a feeling for what's going on.
Yes.
What's the temperament of this exchange with the employee and whoever. But it's ironic about surveillance and DVRs, though, you mentioned, and that's kind of where my little thing was earlier, was, you know, for so long, surveillance and security, physical security companies is just like, hey, we're going to put a camera, it's got a coax back to this video monitor, you're going to put it on a VHS or whatever right. kind of media. And ever since those went digital and DVRs and putting them on Windows servers and all kinds of other, like, a lot of IT, the security was just totally an afterthought. Like, this is a security thing, and we didn't think of anything about implementing some sort of cybersecurity or, like, firmware updates and vulnerabilities that come out on those devices. It's just such an irony to me, because those often come up on, like, a vulnerability scanner.
Oh, absolutely. They always do. And it's always default grids. We want to get into the camera? Hold on. Go look up the model number. Oh, default admin. Thunk, thunk. Look. So I actually have this working theory on that sort of thing. So we deal a lot with the IoT SCADA ICS networks. And same kind of thing, you know, when you're thinking about cameras and DVRs and stuff. So when you're dealing with an engineer and they're going to put a part on let's say a dam or something, their mentality is that part's going to go in for 20 years.
Oh, yeah.
So when they put something in, they want it to last for a very long time. When computers started to be a thing back, you know, however many years ago now, people thought the same thing. You know, you were going to have a computer for a very long time.
It's just going to be another telephone in the house.
Exactly. But we've gone through, we've matured in this computer world where we have realized that you really need to replace these computers every 4 years or 3 years or whatever, hardware and software. And so we've gotten into this mindset of patch management where we are doing more things quickly.
Mm-hmm.
But that engineering mindset in the SCADA and ICS networks, they're still in that 20-year thing. So whereas over here on the computers, we're every 4 years, let's get updates, you know, get updates regularly, you know, monthly, but every 4 years we're replacing it. That's not the same on those. So I think cameras are the same thing, and DVRs, you're not replacing those DVRs every 4 years. Organizations are putting them in.
And there would be a lot of expense to that, because you think about just the desktops alone, the expense that organizations have for that, but something like a DVR solution and...
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the people putting them in are not computer people necessarily.
No. You know, it's funny you say that too, because we remodeled our home a few years back and we bought all new appliances for the kitchen, and talking to, you know, the people, even at the appliance store and the electricians, and it's like the old adage, right? They don't make them like they used to. They literally don't. And they expect these things to fail within the first few years. And so, it was just interesting talking, because like, it'll probably fail. So get the warranty.
Yeah.
It's not like, well, they don't, they might fail, but now it's just an expected thing.
Well, so my house is 82. We have the same oven and the same fridge that was in the house in 82.
Oh, wow.
Everything, you know, the burner top and the microwave is new, and the dishwasher is new. But the microwave, we've just replaced it. This has been the fourth microwave since we've been in the house in the last 13 years.
Yeah.
And the last one, I know this for a fact because this was within a week of everything shutting down for COVID because I had to buy it from Best Buy. It was the only place I could get it. And you had to drive up. You could go in the store. You drive up. They come out and they load it in your car for you. And it was the first time I ever had to do that during the COVID, you know, thing.
Right.
So what was that, 2020?
Yeah.
So that microwave has only lasted us 4 years, maybe three. But yeah, 3 years and we've had to replace it. And what gets me, I'm going to vent a little bit.
Here we go.
Just bear with me. So I told my wife, like, okay, get whatever you want. Just go out and find. And she did the, you know, the reviews, America's
sure.
Test Kitchen, whatever. And she got one that's very similar to the one we had before. It's just a newer version. It's internet connected. It wants to get on the internet.
You know how hard we had to look for these appliances that don't have, that are not,
yes.
Like, my wife and I were both agreed on this. Thank God. It's just like, we don't need a refrigerator that tells us that we're out of milk.
Yes.
We don't, you know, it's just another thing to connect that we need to figure out. Like, I just, but, you know, it's funny. And I was joking earlier in my home, I argued sometimes with clients in the past. It's like, I think my home network probably rivals your commercial network,
right.
Because, you know, there's all these IoT things that you stick
in.
You've got thermostats and lights and all these things.
Oh, yeah.
And they're constantly going out and pinging and doing what they have to do back. I block all that stuff.
Oh, yeah.
So it's like,
I do too.
It's just more work that I would have to put into allowing or disallowing a refrigerator to go out and sell me milk or whatever. You know?
Right. Because I just want something that will work. And I'm like you. I've got a fairly advanced network at home, as I'm otherwise, you know, I have a mesh wireless network and all kinds of, you know, different buildings and whatever. But mostly why I have it is I wanted the firewall. I wanted a nice firewall.
Thank you. That's exactly what I wanted because I wanted to be able to control exactly what's going in and out of the network. And I mean, even talking to, when we arrived here for a little tour, they were talking about, you know, finding like a pet webcam or nanny cams.
Yeah.
These things are out there and people have no idea.
So, I mean, you've been in our SOC.
Yeah, I walked through there. They were talking about it like sometimes on the board there, right?
So they rotate. They've got basically it's a Shodan thing. So you go out and you find cameras and you connect to them. But periodically you're going to get pictures up there of live feeds of stuff you don't want to see. So we have to be really careful because
if that
starts popping up, it's like, oh, okay, let's take that down now. And, and because people will put cameras up for just about anything.
It is.
Yes. And it is scary. So, okay, well, we're right up at 40. Oh, I think you have one more. So give me one more, that security thing. You gave me two. So give me one more. Again, I didn't prepare him for this. I put him on the spot.
No. you know, just thinking through, you know, a good security program is it's really governance. And I say that in from a perspective of if people don't know what to do about security, then they're not doing anything. And if you're not giving them any kind of like, hey, we do security. Great. That's a great policy. What does that mean to people?
Right.
But really that kind of governance and then kind of governance from the top. It has to be part of like the organization and the leadership. And it can't just be that one guy who's like, security, it has to be throughout the organization trying to push the importance of this because again, people only do the bare minimum or nothing. And so,
And it's because not because they're malicious.
No,
it's just, they don't know.
Or I think oftentimes you know, security gets a bad rep in terms of like, it often hinders rather than enables. And so having that mentality at the top of an organization saying, look, we're doing this because we're protecting you, the individual. We're not doing this because we're Gestapo. We're doing this because there are people like you out in the world. We have their information. It could be their sensitive information or not.
Right.
We have sort of an obligation, right? And that that kind of, I think, governance goes a long way too. I'm always of the mindset is like, great, you're telling people that we're doing these things and we should do them, but if you don't tell them why,
Yeah.
Then it's hard to gain agreement on and get them yep. to participate in that. So
yeah, I always, when I talk about GRC or governance, specifically governance, I always talk about it's decision making. Are you making good decisions? Mm-hmm. Are you making good decisions about security? Are you making good decisions about your information security program? Are you making good decisions at your leadership level? People can't make good decisions without good information. They can't make good decisions about security without knowing. Going back to designated qualified individual, that qualified to me is they're making good decisions as it relates to information security. Now you could be using a framework. You know, there's a whole variety out there. You could be looking at regulations. I mean, there's all these different things that help you make good decisions. But fundamentally, it's just the process of, does the organization make good decisions around your information security program?
Word. It's funny. I did a video for my, I posted on LinkedIn a few weeks back. It's sort of the convergence, or I guess it was an article rather, of like regulatory requirements versus frameworks.
Mm-hmm.
And, because I think they just often get thrown around interchangeably. They're not the same. But when you look at them, there's a lot of overlap. And
there is.
It was just an interesting thought I had about, trying to get people to understand. It's like, if you're going to go with this framework, also understand you're probably going to also comply with a lot of these requirements. So right. Don't like spend a lot of effort trying to do both per se. Over time, you'll see that they just really just that becomes your information security program, your cybersecurity program, if that's more your speed.
Right.
Not necessarily having to do both.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. And when I tell people, when I talk to them, I want them to use those frameworks as a framework, but understand that there's so much overlap.
Mm-hmm.
If you take your PCI, with your 12 things of PCI, and then you take your CIS 18, well, there's a significant amount of overlap. Then you take your NIST 53, and again, significant amount of overlap. Then you take your ISO 27001, 27002, overlap. So, right. If you grow and you're doing things good, then you can meet these frameworks and meet these compliances pretty easily.
Exactly. I agree.
So,
are we at time?
I think so.
Okay.
We haven't got the hook yet and no one's throwing anything and we lost our audience. They decided to just leave. So, we're not going to have a
GRC is a little boring, I get it.
I like it.
I do too. It's very much something I enjoy. And, I guess that's why we're in the roles we are, but someone's got to do it, right?
I think that's why they hired me, because I was doing this. I was going to do the stuff that no one else wanted
to
do.
You really don't want to do that. Just can you keep that over there, please?
You contract, Jonathan, you do this. Policies and procedures. No, Jonathan, you just, yeah. I love it. So it sounds like you do too. So. All right. Well, thank you, everybody. We really appreciate you joining us with the Secure AF podcast. We have another great episode coming up soon. And Andrew, thanks for coming by and having a good time.
Me.
And this was a lot of fun. So
it was.
Thank you, everybody.